Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and cosmology consultant, Marcus Chown. And we're talking about his new book, Infinity in the Palm of Your Hand, 50 Wonders That Reveal an Extraordinary Universe. Marcus, welcome back to the show. It's been too long to talk to you again.
It's great to be back. Thanks for inviting me.
This is an interesting group of essays. I strongly recommend this book. But in the foreword, you talk about how a scientist at a party is a lot like a comedian at a party. Talk to me what you mean by that.
Well, well, you know, when you say you're a science writer or a scientist, you know, people kind of expect you to say something interesting about science, you know, something that's going to pique their interest. So I do feel sometimes that I have to come up with something. And I have to say that I do a lot of social media and I do Twitter, and that is really like being a stand-up comedian. So if I'm writing a book, I find something really interesting about science and I just tweet it. And if I get no reaction, I drop it from my book. But if I get a load of reaction, I put it in my book. And this is rather like stand-up comedy where, you know, a comedian knows that their joke falls flat, they leave it out for the next night.
Well, you try out material.
Exactly.
You also use your wife as a sounding board. I love the way you describe that. Like, she'll be watching television, you'll be telling her something interesting, and it was like, oh, okay, whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, I for a long time I was on the staff of an English magazine called New Scientist,
and
a weekly science magazine, and really pretty much that's read by people who have some kind of science background. I mean, there are people that don't, but mostly it is. But I try to write my books for a much more general audience. So my wife, who's a nurse in England, is a really good sounding board because she gets bored very quickly. So I have to think of some better way of saying it.
But as you quote in the book, you quote Carl Sagan, science is stranger than science fiction. And then when you get down to it, first of all, it is actually happening because it's science. It's not fiction. But there's stuff that people just don't understand about how the universe works that really blows your mind all the time.
A lot of it blows my mind all the time. It really does. I mean, one of the things that I often write, I've written books about quantum theory.
Oh, yeah.
You know, quantum theory is really the theory of the microscopic world of atoms and their constituents. And it really is an Alice in Wonderland world, you know. I mean, just beneath the skin of reality, but it's a place where, you know, a single atom can be in two places at once, things happen for no reason at all. You know, an atom can influence another atom on the other side of the universe instantaneously. This is so mad that we could not possibly have invented it, you know. It really is kind of the Harry Potter of science, really.
It really is. I interviewed somebody once, a quantum theorist, and they basically said, don't try to make sense of it, just accept it. That's it. Just like, I know it conflicts with your idea of reality, it conflicts with all our idea of reality. Just accept it because it works.
That is a very, very good piece of advice, because one of the things I find when I give talks is about quantum theory is a surprising number of children come up afterwards. Maybe a third of the audience is like under 12, and my books weren't intended for people that young, but they're not scared. You know, they don't have any fear. And so, we know, an adult reads something and thinks, oh my God, I can't get my head around that. They don't care. And I think it's liberating to realize that you cannot get your head around it. You know, the quantum world is made of objects, if you're going to call them objects, which have no parallel in our everyday experience. But once you realize that, and all you're going to do is get glimpses of this world, you're not going to be able to grasp it in its entirety. I think that's quite liberating.
I do too. And I've actually interviewed other quantum theorists who actually think that, you know, we have a tendency to sort of teach physics like ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. You know, we start with Newton and go through mechanics. And I have come across people who think we should be teaching quantum theory from the very get-go. That
I completely agree with you. I really do. You know, when I was at school in England, what would you call it, junior school? I don't know, not university school, at school. I remember we had to read the works of Charles Dickens when I was about 9, and it put me off Charles Dickens for decades. Now, of course, children will read something like Harry Potter, and that will ignite their interest in reading, and then they'll read all the classics maybe later. And I think we haven't got to that stage with science. You know, you're absolutely right. You learn about Newtonian laws of motion, you learn about gas laws, you know, in historical sequence. But what kids should be taught is the real fun stuff, you know, the fun stuff.
That's right.
If that ignites their interest, they'll learn all the other stuff, you know. So the key thing is to get them interested. And I think, you know, quantum theory and relativity and all these things like string theory are just so amazingly bonkers that they would get kids interested.
Well, I love the way you've arranged these essays. You start out with, the first ones are very, very grounded and sort of Newtonian. And we'll talk about a couple of examples. And then as the book proceeds, it sort of goes down the rabbit hole and to some of the most interesting ideas in physics today. And obviously that was on purpose. But the other thing is, and people need to realize this, I don't think there's an essay over 4 pages long.
Yeah, I mean, my original idea was...
How did you do this? How did you compact all this information in 4 pages?
Well, years ago, I wrote a book, well, not many years ago, called Tweeting the Universe. And it was really, you know, life, the universe, and everything in tweets. I have to say that really each subject was about 10 tweets, because at that time, they're only 140 characters long. So I've kind of got used to writing things quite concisely. And I did an app called Solar System for iPad, where I had to write, I think, about 150 stories about the solar system. And each of them had to be about 230 words long, something like that. So I have got kind of used to this. I mean, obviously, it's like writing in a straitjacket. And if you had more room, obviously...
Well, you could write a book about every one of these essays could be a book.
I think so, yeah. I mean, again, illustrating what a wonderful universe we find ourselves in. You know, yeah, absolutely, many of these topics. So it was difficult to compress them, but hopefully they are intelligible, you know.
They're very intelligible.
Yeah, and I start with something, hopefully, that grabs your interest, you know, like you could squeeze the whole human race in the volume of a sugar cube, and then I use that to lead into something, you know, the explanation for that is quantum theory. So hopefully you start off with the attention-grabbing fact, and then you get the really profound science that's behind it.
Let's talk about several of these essays. We cannot possibly talk about even most of these essays. People are going to have to pick up the book. And a very simple observational one, which maybe people have never even thought of. When the tide at sea rises, the water in wells fall. That sounds like some kind of code phrase for spies. You know, they meet each other on the street when the tide at the sea rises, and then the guy answers, the water in the well falls.
Well, isn't that incredible? Because I wrote this book called The Ascent of Gravity, which is out in America, actually.
Yep.
It was my previous book. And I was writing about the tides. And when I was writing about the tides, obviously Newton was the person who figured out why we have two tides every day. In fact, two tides every 25 hours. He was the person who realized, you know, how the moon and the sun did that. But I've discovered that this thing you've just mentioned, that when the sea rises at high tide, the water in wells drops. And apparently this has been known since 100 BC. And it was only explained in about 1940. So isn't that incredible? I suppose you want me to explain it.
We got to explain a few of them to give people first of all, that seems counterintuitive.
Yes, it does. But isn't that incredible that it was noticed in 100 BC? It was noticed in Spain by a Greek who wrote about it. And yet that's not a piece of common knowledge, you know. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
I still find it quite remarkable.
I know. Now I feel compelled to go out and look in a well at high tide. I mean, I'm serious.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I want to see this effect.
Yeah, and it's because the tides, as Newton realized, are caused by, well, principally the moon, but the sun has an effect as well. But basically, the moon's gravity pulls a bulge of the ocean upwards.
That's right.
It pulls a bulge of the ocean, and the Earth rotates through that bulge. And that's why you see tides. But it also pulls a bulge in the land. It's just it's smaller, you know, because rock is a bit tougher than water. So if you imagine something like a well, it's obviously in water. It's been dug in waterlogged ground, and so when the rock bulges upwards, it's kind of what did it do? It squeezes water into the well.
Wow.
It sucks water into the rock.
Right.
And then when the bulge drops back down again, when the moon moves, then the water gets squeezed back into the... Well, that's right. I think I've got it right. So you get the water coming up when the tide drops and vice versa.
The amazing thing about this and reading it for me was that this effect had been known for so long and yet had not been adequately explained up until relatively recently.
Until 1940, by an American geologist in about 1940. I know.
Doesn't it seem like sort of like one of those things would be attempted to be explained, like back in the 1700s or something?
Was Newton even aware of this fact? You know, was he, if he had been aware of it, I'm sure he would have explained it. I mean, basically.
Or ignore it.
Well, he used every observation and every technique he had in the 17th century to explain the world he could see around him. But yeah, I mean, and this effect is incredibly, you know, it has an effect. You know, the Large Hadron Collider, which is this giant particle accelerator, which straddles the boundary between France and Switzerland. It's, I think, about 21 miles long, 21 kilometers, I can't remember now. It's just a ring, and subatomic particles are accelerated around it and smashed together. I think 1990s, the predecessor of the Large Hadron Collider, which was the Large Electron Positron Collider, they noticed that the energy of the electrons that were being circulated changed twice a day. And, you know, they were scratching their heads and they couldn't figure out what was happening. They had to obviously boost the energy of the electrons when it dropped. And then they suddenly realized it was actually the moon. And what the moon was doing was pulling a bulge in the land that the tunnel is tunneled into and changing the length of the ring by about a millimeter twice a day. And that change in length of a millimeter was enough to change the energy of the electron. So incredibly, you know, we have this amazingly, obviously the most complex experiment in the world, the Large Hadron Collider, you know, pushing the frontiers of physics, and it's being affected by twice a day by the tides pulled by the moon.
Well, the amazing thing is that they didn't think about that beforehand. It's like the obvious stuff that's in front of our face, we still don't have a complete grip on.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they were thinking about all the intricacies of subatomic particle collisions, but they weren't thinking about this bit of physics that Isaac Newton would have understood.
Like this big thing in the big thing in the sky that's staring down at you. It's like,
yeah,
and who'd have thought?
Time before somebody thought, wait a minute, this is happening once every, twice every 25 hours.
What does that relate to? I'd like to have been at that meeting because it'd been somebody who finally goes,
yeah.
Do you think it could be the moon? And everybody looks around to each other and what?
Well, it is incredible. I mean,
it is amazing.
One of the things I wrote about in the Ascent of Gravity was going to see the Severn Bore. The Severn is the longest river in Britain, and in autumn and in the spring, you get the Severn Bore, which is this hummock of water, which travels the wrong way up the river at quite a speed, and people surf it. I mean, the record, I think someone surfed it for about 21 kilometers.
Oh, wow!
And this happens on many rivers around the world. In fact, there's a river in China where the bore is very, very high. It's higher than a house. And every year when it comes up the river, you know, the Chinese authorities warn people not to stay to be on the bank, and many people are killed every single year. And what gets me about these bores is they're relatively localized. You know, they're not like the tides where the whole ocean rises up and drops down. This is a hummock of water about the size of a human being.
That's right.
That you can surf, and it's created by the moon. Now, I mean, obviously, in hundreds of years ago, people would have realized that this appeared to be associated with, you know, seeing a full moon in the sky. So they must have guessed that there was some connection. But it just amazes me that something a quarter of a million miles away across space then can create something so small and so localized as a hummock of water racing the wrong way up a river.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and cosmology consultant Marcus Chown. And we're talking about his new book. I love this book, Infinity in the Palm of Your Hand, 50 Wonders That Reveal an Extraordinary Universe. And what's amazing, Marcus, is there's several essays just about planetoids or moons in our own solar system that are just so weird. When you look at things like Io and other of these moons, there are things that Europa is another good one. There are things just in our own backyard that are so different from things that we are familiar with here on Earth.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to spend this entire conversation talking about tides, but I mean, Io, you just mentioned, is a giant moon of Jupiter, and it looks like a pizza. it's all yellow and red and brown and whatever, and it is stretched and squeezed by the gravity not only of Jupiter but the neighboring moons. And this, if you got a squash ball and you squeezed it repeatedly in your hand, it would get hot. So the interior of this moon is very, very hot, and in fact it generates the most heat pound for pound of anybody in the solar system,
including the sun.
Exactly. The sun is incredibly bad at generating heat. So bad that if you were to take a chunk of the center of the sun, the same size and shape as your stomach generates heat at a greater rate. So the sun is incredibly inefficient at generating heat. You might think, well, how come it's so hot? It's so hot because there's a lot of it. There isn't just one chunk the size of your stomach. There's countless quadrillion chunks the size of your stomach all stacked together, and that's why it's hot. But actually, it's using the most inefficient nuclear reaction to generate heat that you can possibly imagine. And thank goodness it is.
I know.
Because it's taken it 5 billion years. It's been burning steadily for 5 billion years and will burn for another 5 billion years because it's not squandering its energy. It's burning at an incredibly slow rate, which is good for the evolution of intelligent life like us.
That's right. Now, you talked before about squeezing all of humanity into the palm of your hand, and people might go, how can you do that? How can you fit all of humanity? And the truth is, and I love this, we're mostly empty space.
Well, dramatically so, yeah. I mean, quite incredibly. I mean, we're ghosts. We probably learn at school about that we're made of atoms. They're the basic building blocks of everything. But an atom has a nucleus at the center, which is rather like the sun, around which electrons orbit like planets, And the British playwright Tom Stoppard had a really good image. He said, if the nucleus in an atom were like the altar at the heart of St. Paul's Cathedral, I don't know if St. Paul's Cathedral in London is that one with the big dome,
right,
then an electron in the atom would be like a moth in the cathedral, one minute fluttering by the altar, the next by the dome. But even that doesn't really tell you how much empty space there is, because I can tell you how much empty space there is in an atom as a percentage. So I'm going to count it off on my fingers. It's 99.9999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999 atoms, that if you could squeeze all the empty space out of all the atoms in all 7 billion people on Earth, they would indeed fit in the volume of a sugar cube.
But it would weigh a tremendous amount.
It would weigh a tremendous amount. And you may think to yourself, isn't this all hypothetical? But no, it isn't, because out in space are objects called neutron stars. They're the end point of the evolution of a massive star. So a star blows up as a supernova. And paradoxically, when it blows its outer layers into space, its core implodes. And all the empty space is squeezed out of all the atoms in that core. And what you end up with is something called a neutron star, which is about the size of Mount Everest, but it's got the mass of a whole star. And if you were to go to such a star and dig out a chunk the size of a sugar cube, it would indeed weigh as much as a human race. So it's not just hypothetical.
No, it's not. Now, there's some things I definitely learned in your book, and one of them was As a matter of fact, I'm going to hope to read a book about this. There's a thing called the Carrington Event, September 1st, 1859. And this has to do with coronal mass ejections, or CMEs. I had never heard of the Carrington Event before.
Well, it's an incredibly pivotal moment in the history of astronomy, because really before that, we're talking about 1850. What did you say?
1859.
Before that moment, it was considered that the only effect that the sun, for instance, had on the Earth was obviously its gravity, you know, keeping the Earth orbiting the sun, and its heat. But then it was suddenly discovered that it had a magnetic effect. And this was a guy called Richard Carrington. He noticed that there was a flare on the surface of the sun. At the same time, a magnetometer, this was a device that could detect magnetic field, just went off scale at Kew Gardens, which is Botanical Gardens in London. And he made this connection, and it was very, very controversial. And it turns out that we do now know that our sun is actually incredibly active. It's not just a ball of hot gas. It has these magnetic fields, a strong magnetic field. And because the different latitudes of the sun rotate at different rates, the interior rates, rotates at a different rate to the surface, these magnetic field lines get all kind of twisted up like rubber bands.
Whoa.
And then when they get so twisted, they snap and they eject a large amount of material into space. And this event, called the Carrington Event, was the biggest flare in recorded history. If it happened today, we would be plunged back to the pre-electrical era, because it would generate, as the magnetic field from this ejected material came through the Earth, it would induce massive electrical currents in our transformers and in our long-distance power lines, electrical equipment, wipe out our satellites and everything. That's a slight worry.
Like, Marcus, you can't just leave it that way. Is there a possibility that that could happen?
Well, it's a big worry. It is a really big worry, which I don't think, I mean, I don't want to, you know, with global warming and all the other things, I don't want to make you lose sleep, but it is one of the major dangers that we face. In recent years, we've observed a lot of other stars which are like our sun, lots and lots of them. And on them, we've actually discovered that they have these flares more often than our sun.
Uh-oh.
Could we be going through a quiet phase? Could these things happen more? I mean, on many sun-like stars, we see flares which would be enough to fry a planet.
Oops.
So we don't know, unfortunately, how frequent Carrington events are, but we are pretty vulnerable because of our planet is girdled by communication satellites.
Oh, yeah.
Earth observation satellites, all this stuff. I mean, there's even a plan, isn't there, by, is it Elon Musk? I'm not sure, to put up hundreds of satellites to create global internet access. And the problem is, of course, even in the early days of satellites, you know, when we're talking about the early 1960s, the components, the transistors and things were quite big and robust. But of course now we can pack millions or even billions of as many transistors on a tiny chip, and that makes them much smaller and much more vulnerable. So yeah, I mean, I don't. This is a major threat to our technological civilization.
Well, you know, people have actually suggested. This sounds like people have thought about electromagnetic weapons. So that they would explode. For instance, if you exploded a nuclear bomb, not on the ground, but above a city, it would create electromagnetic radiation that would put out all the computers and all the... And this sounds like a big version of that.
Exactly. It's a big version. I mean, we've had these...
Is there any periodicity to these things? Or are they just like happen and we don't know when and where?
Actually, no. I mean, we do know that the sun has a solar cycle. So its magnetic field builds and dies. Well, in fact, it reverses, actually, every 22 years or every 11 years. It's called the solar cycle. Looking at historical records, we think that cycle has existed for at least 300 or 400 years. We've got absolutely no idea why that cycle exists, but we would expect that these flares would probably be related to that cycle. But nobody really knows. I mean, there was a major flare which wiped out the power system in Quebec in the late 80s. I mean, many millions of people were left without power. So that just shows you what these things can do.
Okay, well, let's. We just have minutes left, and I just want to mention there's so much in this book, and we've not even scratched the real juicy stuff yet. But there's a picture I had never seen, the one that was taken by Voyager 1, where after it passed the gas giants, I think it was I believe it was Carl Sagan who asked them to turn the camera back towards Earth.
Yes.
And I looked that photo up, and what a dramatic feeling you get from looking at that photo.
Well, that's very interesting, yeah. I mean, it's a dot. There are some bands of color across that picture, yep, which turn out to not real. They're actually caused by light bouncing around inside a Voyager camera. But, you know, Sagan had that idea, that brilliant idea, to turn the camera back the way it was, you know, the Voyager had been coming. And it took him a long time to persuade the team members to do it. But then what you actually get is that it's a picture of a dot. And until
it's a little blue, it's a little blue dot.
That's right. And until someone tells you what it is, you don't realize how amazing it is, because all human history has been played out on that dot.
That's right.
All life on Earth has evolved on that dot. All 7 billion of us live on that dot, because obviously it's planet Earth, and it just puts everything into perspective. And I tweet these kind of pictures, and that gets the biggest response of anything you tweet, because I think that people are constantly looking downwards. They're worried about the problems in their everyday lives and politics and all this sort of stuff. But this just puts everything in perspective. You know, we're all on this. There are 100 billion stars in our galaxy, probably more planets than there are stars. There are 2 trillion galaxies. In all of that, there are more stars, more planets in the universe, and there are sand grains on all the beaches, around all the continents on Earth, yet there's only one place where we know there is life, you know, that tiny little fragile blue dot. And when you see it, it's just surrounded by blackness, isn't it?
Isolated. It's amazing. It's really scary. And it's humbling. It's humbling, and it really gives you pause.
It's very humbling.
It really
but
is.
But also, it makes you think we're all on this planet together. We've got to get on.
We got to. We're out of time. We're out of time. We haven't even gotten to the weird stuff, which I'd love to talk about, which is that we may be living in a giant hologram, or the multiverses, which I'm always up for talking about. But you're going to have to buy the book to get those essays. My guest tonight is writer and cosmology consultant Marcus Chown. And we've been talking about his new book. It is really fun, interesting, and it'll give you a lot to think about. Infinity in the Palm of Your Hand. 50 Wonders That Reveal an Extraordinary Universe. Marcus, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks very much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.